Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today's program is seasonal, isn't it?
Well, sort of. I mean, I guess it's southern, and in the southern, I guess they do pretty much everything the same all year round.
Yeah, I guess so.
And a lot of it's barbecue, and there's a lot of other traditional stuff as well. And they have a marvelous spokesperson for everything southern to do with food called John. Why does everybody always say his middle initial, John T. Edge?
Because there are more John Edges, I think. I don't know.
Of the Southern Foodways Alliance. So he's kicking off. He's kicking off today's program.
He's an authority on just about everything he tackles. I mean, he's really...
Plus, he's a beautiful writer. His books...
Yeah, his books are well written.
His books would be good if they were about soap or shampoo or something like that. And then who have we got next? And then next we have somebody who's in favor of Texas steakhouses, I think.
Yes. John Tesser, yes.
John Tesser. And he's got something to do with knives, too.
Well, that's the name of the book, isn't it?
I think so, something like that. And then no program about barbecue would be complete without another contribution from Steve Recklin, who just came out with his umpteenth book about barbecue, which is more definitive than all the other ones put together.
Well, he's concentrating, as he says, on sauces, rubs, and marinades.
Okay, anyway, that's today's program. So
you should learn a lot and be able to apply this information immediately in the hot weather.
Yeah, and hang in there, because here comes John T.
John T. Edge, I think that you probably have a better handle on the South, old and new, than most people I know. And this book is a wonder unto itself, The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. I think that what I asked you is how long it took you to write it, because it's so thoroughly researched. What did you tell me?
Well, it took me, I guess I tried to write this beginning in 10 years ago, and I found a way to write it 5 years ago and got a deadline 3 years ago.
Which you didn't make.
No, actually, I made my deadline.
Oh, did you really? Okay.
Yeah. I made my deadline. It's the only way I can get work done is to set a deadline and back one deadline up against the other. And if you miss one deadline, it throws everything off. And if you know that fear, then you'll make the first deadline.
Now, let's talk about the title. Let's define potlicker for those who don't know what that is.
Sure. So when you cook a pot of greens or you cook a pot of beans, say that pot's bobbing with a hock of pork or a pigtail or some salt pork, whatever it might be. When you cook that pot of greens or beans down, the liquid leavings at the bottom of the pot, the kind of distilled essence of the pot, is the pot liquor. Especially in the case with greens, that's where all the nutrients reside, that they're leached out of the leaves and end up in the bottom of the pot. It's a nutrient-rich dish that, for me, is both an actual food and kind of a metaphor for writing about the South. And in this book, I distill down 60 years of the South through food, and potlicker is a great way of kind of thinking about that, talking about that. At least I hope it is.
Well, no, I mean, that gave us a clue to what this book is about. You said 60 years. Now, it was based on, I love your foreword. Explain what you did with this foreword.
Well, my mentor in this world was long John Edgerton, and for 20-odd years, we worked together, and he inspired me and counseled me. And I always imagined that I might try to write a book that complements his. He wrote a beautiful book called Southern Food, At Home, on the Road, and in History, in the late 1980s, that book came out. And I always imagined that if I found a way to write a book that complemented his, might be a follow-on to his, that he would write my foreword. And when he passed in 2013, I decided instead that when I published my book, I would write a foreword to him and speak in that moment of his influence on me and on what I think of as two generations of writers in the South, and a his counsel and his challenge to all of us to do better and to think about the social and cultural and racial implications of writing about the South, and not treat food as something frivolous, but treat food as something deeply important.
Yeah, it's food is the culture or the expression of the culture, and you break that down. And I think maybe we should let you explain, in case somebody doesn't know, what the Southern Foodways Alliance is, which is very important.
So the link there, John was the founder of the SFA, conceived the idea along with Natalie Dupree and others. That organization, which I now direct at the University of Mississippi, documents and studies and explores the diverse food cultures of the American South. In many ways, through film, through oral history, through a podcast called Gravy and a journal with the same name, we tell stories about the American South that complicate people's understandings of the South, that through food we address those issues I mentioned a moment ago, you know, racism and its impact on the region, class difference, inequity, gender inequity, all those ways in which the South has long been riled by problems. Food offers us a way to think about those, to also grasp progress over time as well. So that work, the Southern Foodways Alliance, is very much in lockstep with my attempt in this book, which is to tell a story of the South over a period of time that begins in 1955 when, by my lights, the South really begins to change. And that 1955 moment's when the Montgomery bus boycotts come into play.
So you've been following social history of the South for a long time, and you just decided this was a point at which there was a sea change. Now, I noticed something else, and I didn't see the thread all the way through, but you do actually trace back the roots of food in the South back to the time when the people from my native land first started showing up here.
Yeah, I didn't go that deep into kind of a prehistory of the South or a history of the South before the Civil Rights Movement.
But there is a little bit there. You talk about, for example, the origins of pork in the South seem to go back to pigs that came over to Jamestown.
Sure. Yeah. There's depth to be explored there. I'm most interested, as y'all know, in that kind of 1950s, 1960s period forward. But there's much more to explore in terms of the kind of roots of those kind of elemental foods of the South, like the pig, like corn. They can tell us a lot, too.
Our daughter and son-in-law and their two children lived for less than just under a dozen years in Greenwood, South Carolina. So I experienced some of the, before that I had only experienced like the Southern culture of Charleston. And there is a sea of difference between Greenville and Greenwood and Charleston. I mean, Greenville is a modernized city and it happens to have the new wealth brought in, by major corporations. I would say that Greenwood, which centers around, in theory, the lake and resort district, once you get through that, it's a totally different culture. It really is a throwback culture.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you think about, we talk about the South and we talk about Southern culture, but, you know, in physical size and certainly in geographical diversity, the South is comparable to Western Europe in terms of geographical size. It's, you know, it is a region, and it is a region of many subregions as well.
Yeah, we interviewed John Besh about, I'm trying to remember which book it was. I think it was the first time that I realized that there was a huge settlement of Sicilians in New Orleans. And I just read the most fascinating article about they had human trafficking from central political power in central Italy to get Italians as more or less indentured slaves in the New World. In which state was it? It was Tennessee. Was it Tennessee?
I don't know.
You didn't read it. It was in The Economist, no less.
I passed it over to you, and I think it was. I think it might have been Arkansas, but I'm not sure.
Oh, Arkansas. That was it.
It was indeed Arkansas.
Yeah.
You saw it too?
Yeah, I know that story. It's a deeply complicated one, and you know, the story of labor and agriculture and religion, and a fascinating one, worthy of more exploration too.
Now you don't miss a lot. I've noticed.
I miss a whole bunch, but I appreciate the compliment.
And one of the interesting things, and let's come back to this one, because it's a story in and of itself, and that's the cast of characters you introduce us to.
Oh, they're wonderful.
So you bring us characters like Sean Brock and try to explain how they got the way they are, and Julian Van Winkle,
yeah,
and his Burma, and you introduce what they brought into the game. But before we go back to that, one of the things that struck me was that in the era that you're talking about in your book, there was an enormous amount of inward migration. We talk about the South, if you like, as a source of outward migration of the African American ex-slaves heading north to work in factories in the northern parts of the United States.
Right.
But not exactly in their place, but there has been a significant amount of in-migration of people, for example, from Southeast Asia, who have now occupied the Old South in their own way and changed it in their own way.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting and dynamic stories in the South today is, you know, for the longest time, we define the South as a place of black and white. And the kind of demographic destiny of the region, just like the demographic destiny of our nation, tells us otherwise. And, you know, I live in a South, and I live in a small town in the South today where, you know, my son and I, our Saturday lunch is more likely to be tacos al pastor.
Yeah, I love that story.
Than it is barbecue.
I love the story of your relationship to the South and understanding of the food even of the South and you know, the Civil War, for example, and your sons and the story of the half. I mean, it's really a wonderful, I don't know what the age difference is, but it's certainly a generation's difference, right?
Right.
Yeah. But I know I remember when the first Vietnamese restaurant opened in New Orleans, and I can't remember the name of it, but I was really shocked. And it turned into a mini empire for the chef restaurateur.
And right.
You know who that is? Probably, I don't remember. But then the other piece of it is the Mexicans, and even in Greenwood, South Carolina, the Latino population was enormous for that size town.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you think about a city like Charlotte, North Carolina, you know, at a time when Charlotte was booming, still is, but, you know, as Charlotte rose to become the banking capital of the U.S. and as skyscrapers rose above that city, Mexican-American labor built those skyscrapers, and Mexican-American laborers are hungry at midday, and what are they going to eat? They're going to want to eat the foods of their homeland, tacos and tortas and the like. And those foods percolate through the South as a whole. And for, you know, my son, who's now 16, he's grown up in a South that is as much about tacos as it is about barbecue sandwiches or bowls of gumbo. And that I think is positive. I don't think we lose much in that exchange. I think we do gain much in that exchange. New peoples, new spices, new ideas, new beauty to behold.
Now, there are many cities in the South, of course, because the South itself is a big place, I guess, stretching all the way from Arkansas on one side to Georgia and South Carolina and Florida on the other side. But two cities, it seems to me, stand out. One is Charleston and the other is New Orleans.
Yeah,
and it's not that these are particularly large cities, because neither of them are.
Right.
But during the time that you're writing about, they from a culinary standpoint, they have changed enormously.
They have. You know, those cities have become kind of culinary citadels. They've become the cities to which tourists flock to kind of have the grand experience of eating out in the finest restaurants in the South, and the restaurants that interpret the cuisines of those places, very place-specific cuisines, that of Low Country, South Carolina, and that of the Gulf South, Gulf of Mexico, in Louisiana. Those cities, you know, there's a tension in both of those cities about whose food will be kind of the future tense food of the South. Is it working class food? Is it African American food? Is it Gullah and Creole food of Louisiana, of New Orleans? Is it Gullah food of South Carolina? And, you know, those places offer us an opportunity to ask those questions, and to ask those questions while enjoying red rice in Charleston, or you know, in thinking about Vietnamese cookery. You know, I'm as likely now to sit down to a bowl of pho or banh mi as I am a bowl of gumbo and a po' boy in New Orleans.
Right.
Now, one of the things that makes this book interesting is John T. Edge is not shy. and there was much controversy in this household, as well as yours and many across the country, when a restaurant called Hominy Grill won a James Beard Award for Best Restaurant South.
Yeah.
and you didn't duck away from that one.
No, I think that was a prescient award. I think that Robert Stelling's award for Hominy Grill, at a time when that restaurant wasn't always open even for dinner, some folk caterwauled over that.
Yeah, I did. It beat out Fig. I couldn't believe it.
There was one in this house.
But I was irate.
But see, Mike gets the credit that he's due in this book. That's the amazing.
Of course.
That's the amazing thing. You didn't miss anybody.
Well, I hope I didn't try to miss it. I tried my darndest not to miss anybody, but I do want to make that point that I think, like, beautifully executed casual food is the future of American dining, the future of Southern dining, and you know what Robert Stelling does at Hominy Grill is gorgeously executed, democratically priced, and deeply important.
Yeah. Well, now there was literally an elephant in the room as I was reading about it, that you kind of backed into a little bit. There's all the scandal over Paula Deen, but you know, Paula.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd forgotten about the sandwich.
He didn't shirk that one either.
Well, he didn't. Yeah, but the thing that you didn't really hit really hard on, it's something that's overshadowed Southern cooking, is the unhealthy aspects of it. And I think, I mean, you watched what's his name eat himself to death. I'm not doing well in names today.
Paul Prudhomme
eat himself to death. And then you have Paula, who was selling what was that sandwich between two donuts, and it was disgusting, and she had hid that she was diabetic. And and you do mention the fact that a lot of the poor went from having distended bellies from starvation to being the cheap carbs and being obese. So how do you overcome? I mean, is it intrinsically unhealthy, the food in the South?
Well, I think that the sort of food that Paula Deen has promoted is intrinsically unhealthy, and I think it's also dishonest. I don't think she represents or promotes an accurate. She does not represent an accurate South. Lord, I can't speak well. She inaccurately represents this region she pretends to speak for.
Uh-huh.
And I think that kind of, you know, fried chicken between two Krispy Kreme donuts
that was
kind of cuisine is stunt food. it is food meant to evince a reaction from someone. It is not food meant for mortals to eat. But you know, I think her, Paula Deen's story, and her sins are more about sins of misattribution and lack of attribution for African American labor. The dietary stuff is troubling to me, but more troubling are those deeper cultural fissures that her career brings into focus.
Well, you know, her sons wrote that book, which took Paula's classic recipes and kind of
took all the calories out.
Yeah, slimmed them down.
That was well done. He was a good interview.
He was funny. but no, I mean, I think that's something that's overshadowed. So it's good to have an influx of some of these other influences, with the Asian cuisine and Mexican cuisine and so forth into the traditional, sweet tea and
pimento
cheese, whatever it is. But, yeah.
I want us to look forward, John.
Yeah,
As we conclude, I want to look forward. Because I want to look forward from a time when Lee Circle will no longer have a statue of Robert E. Lee in the middle. something about that seems like an overreaction. But I'm wondering if having seen that happen or saying, God, this would never happen. He's going to be there forever. Is there something that you can see in the future beyond this book that you will include in it when you do a second version of it 10 years from now?
I do. I mean, I think there are many foods of the American South that we once thought were imperiled, that in my research for this book and in paying attention to the South over the last generation, I guess, we once thought barbecue was imperiled. We wondered when the EPA would declare that burning wood was
carcinogenic.
Yeah, back before the EPA was back when the EPA was something that was a strong force in our nation.
Yeah, let's not go there.
and we wondered when, in essence, kind of the last pitmaster would step out of the smoke and hang up his smock. And in fact, barbecue has proved quite resilient. There's a younger generation of pitmasters, people like Samuel Jones of Aden and Greenville, North Carolina, people like Rodney Scott of Charleston, South Carolina.
And that guy in Nashville is good.
Yeah, Pat Martin as well.
Martin.
Those pitmasters, those younger generation have proved to us that barbecue will endure. If anything, I think barbecue is if it's not as accessible as it always has been, it's certainly more popular. People talk about it. People take pilgrimages to eat it. Barbecue is a deeply important part of our kind of cultural conversations today, and that's hopeful and is a connection to that kind of mythical past, the way people view the American South. It's this place of great and long tradition, and barbecue brings that into relief.
Well, there are many things that we could talk about. I wish we could talk at greater length about some of these, John, because you've thought them through for years and years and years, and I really think it would be mindful of people to actually get this book called The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South, to put what you think is the food of the South into its perspective as frequently a stereotype which has no validity in the future at all, probably.
Well, I think that there will be continuity with the past. I just think it's important that we recognize that culture is a process and not a product. Places and people and food continue to change, and I embrace that change. I don't reject it.
Well, love it, John. Thank you so much for talking to us about this wonderful book.
Thank y'all for the good questions and the kindness. I appreciate it.
And don't go away, because we'll have another man named John coming back right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
no less a person than Anthony Bourdain says, a man is the most talented cook I ever worked with. Then I guess you pay attention. And John Tesar, spelled T-E-S-A-R, but pronounced as though he's involved with beverages rather than with food, decided he would write his first book on the subject of steakhouses, but steakhouses with a difference. Steakhouses that you can simulate at home. So let's hear what John Tesar has to say about Knife, Texas Steakhouse Meals at Home.
John Tesar, you're legendary in my book. I mean, you said before that you were not a well-known celebrity chef. Well, you sure are in my book. I've heard about you for years and years and years.
Thank you very much, Anne.
Yeah, and we're here talking about this. I said it was a wonderful book. It really is. It's called Knife, which is, of course, the name of your restaurant in Dallas, subtitled Texas Steakhouse Meals at Home. And I'm not sure, I mean, there's so much information in this book. I don't know how you were able to write it. Yeah, and I don't know, really, I should be able to absorb all this and make a perfect steak.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I wanted to do a cookbook for a long, long time, but I also, through my process of developing Knife and learning about all this beef, we had to first introduce people to who I was, and then secondly, we had to go through the process that I went through and learn about the animal husbandry, the breeding, the different types of cuts and everything that kind of creates Knife, and then also, you know, put it together in a fashion that would be great for the home cook as well. So it was quite an amazing project, and Jordan McKay is an amazing writer and was able to capture.
He's a co-writer, yes. And you're going to go on another project with him, you said.
I hope to write several more books with him. You know, some about the restaurant industry for the last 30, 40 years. And I think hopefully a dry aging book to get more specific and get into the actual organic chemistry of it.
Well, I tell you what, before we forget to mention this, listeners, if you're interested in finding out about not just how to cook these things, but a tutorial in why.
Yes.
This is the book to get, because John goes to all the trouble of explaining why, as he just explained to his writer, I guess. So you became something of an expert in how to explain things.
Exactly. And that's the way I cook anyway. I'm very analytical. I believe in simplicity, you know, and it's just an analytical way of working through things step by step. And hopefully when you pick up the book and see what we've done, you'll understand that.
And you mustn't be put off by the fact that on the front cover is a man with two long knives.
That was not my idea.
That was not your idea. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's a bit put off, and you look kind of unhinged, John.
Yeah. I was like, why am I standing here with two large knives? Am I going to be scaring people away from buying my book? But they wanted to represent that imagery. So, you know, Will Schwede at McMillan Flatiron is an amazing guy, and he gave me the opportunity to do this book. And when they said they wanted to publish it, I was ecstatic. So I let him call the shots all the way through, because I know about as much about writing a book as I do about flying an airplane.
Well, you go through all the basics, telling people, and you're so straightforward, almost blunt, I mean, I would say, about the meat itself. What to get, all the techniques that are involved, and people get so complicated about steak, and then you present your philosophy of back to the pan.
Yeah, I mean, it's real. That's the way the home cook can actually duplicate what gets done in the steakhouse. And then, you know, blunt is exactly my last name should have been Blunt. You know, I grew up in New York City, and I'm 59 years old, and I'm tired of a lot of BS. So I've learned how to kind of roll up my sleeves and just kind of, I've always kind of tell it like it is kind of guy. So, but that development of the Maillard and using that spring pan and the aggressive heat from the cassette burner, It creates a far better end result than throwing something on a grill in the backyard. And, you know, I cook over a lot of live fire, but, you know, most steakhouses, the reason why you go to a, you know, X, Y, and Z steakhouse are hopefully nice is that that bone is in the meat, it's cut thick, and it's done in a steak broiler at almost a million BTUs to pull the collagen out of the bone, to render the fat, to develop that maillard and give the crust to that salt and pepper. And that's what makes a great steak. And you would think that that's so easy, but it's not that easy. And people mess it up all the time.
I was looking for the chapter about how to become as rude as a waiter at Peter Luger. somehow that got left out.
That's because I don't work there. And, but you have to be like 70 years old and Yugoslavian to understand that.
Seriously, it's a difficult question for you to answer, but I'm sure you know. Luger is legendary. Sparks Steakhouse and Smith and Walensky, I think it is. And there are some in San Francisco, there are some in Los Angeles, there are some in Chicago.
Florida.
And they call themselves steakhouses.
Yes, sir.
Ruth Chris is another one, I guess. Morton's is another one. How is your steakhouse experience different?
Well, first of all, we've made it more affordable. We made things larger to be shared. We seriously dry age anywhere from 45 days to 400 days.
Oh, my goodness.
How do you do that? I've read that in your book. I mean, how come it doesn't go rotten?
Well, Adam Perry Lang worked with Mario Batali at Corne Vino and developed this 240-day reserva. And in the process of developing Nice, I traveled around the country and literally ate at all these steakhouses that you just mentioned. Plus, I went to the chef-driven venues that serve meat, red meat. And Adam is a great guy out here in Los Angeles, and he let me into his world, and I kind of learned that at a very low humidity and a very low temperature, you can develop white mold, and that's what we're doing is we're developing penicillin, and that white mold kills the black mold and allows us to dry age at a very, very long period of time. Now, what happens at that time, though, it becomes like winemaking. Each animal is different. Each primal is different. Each piece is different. Then you have to taste, and then you have to pass that description on to the customer. And in the process, I found that the 44 Farms beef that we buy from Cameron, Texas, and also the Hart brand, the Akiyushi beef, because of the feed programs, they get sweeter as they get older, where real corn-fed animals were getting ammoniated as we tried to age them longer. So
there
really is some education and learning in this process, and I've spent the last 3 years developing this technique, and thanks to Adam's, you know, temperatures, I was able to take that out of my own and develop it, and that's what makes it.
He's wonderful. He's really terrific.
Yeah, would you be sure?
And we don't use any butter. We don't use any butter also, and that's another thing. Butter to me is like a crutch for steak. If you want to put butter on steak, you know, a lot of those steakhouses you mentioned, they serve you a 600-degree plate smothered in butter.
Chris does that with the butter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, would you do this, make a little mental note, please remember us to Adam Perry Lang, because hopefully he'll remember when we interviewed him at Barbacoa in London.
Oh, yeah, that was good.
When he was working for Jamie Oliver in that fabulous steakhouse there.
I will. Adam is a meat expert and an aficionado, and he's opening a restaurant in Los Angeles.
Oh, he is. Oh, great.
Yeah. And he cooks quite frequently, you know, backstage at Jimmy Kimmel out here in the L.A. I'm actually out here today to shoot a TV show. So I'm a big fan of Adam, and I owe a lot to him as far as the aging process goes, the learning. But then the feed issue is something that we're developing, improving right now. We're trying to get with Texas Tech a professor, Dr. Miller, down there to actually prove this through organic chemistry. And that'll hopefully be in the next book about dry aging.
Well, you know, this. I was glad to read your comments on grass-fed beef, because I had to, and some others, chefs and food writers and so forth, we had to judge a grass-fed beef contest. And I tell you the difference between the lowest level and taste level and the top of the line was so extreme that we were divided into two groups and then merged, and there was no question that the top producers were so clearly different and ahead of the others. And
I agree. That's just very difficult.
Yeah, well, they say, well, you should always get grass-fed beef. Well, some of that grass-fed beef, I couldn't even chew.
Yeah, and there are some cheaters out there, too, because the FDA allows you sometimes when you're grass-feeding to put a little corn out in the pasture, a certain amount. And, you know, I've been around cows and bulls for a while now. If there's some corn out there and they find it, they're going to go back to that repeatedly. But I most recently found a brand called Nature in Texas, and I've been working with them to try to develop consistency and buying, you know, whole sides of beef and really learning more about grass-fed, because I believe there's some value to it. You know, it's not only the health aspects of the fact that the cholesterol is one-to-one, good to bad, where in corn-fed beef or traditional beef, it's 15-to-1 bad cholesterol to good cholesterol. So, I mean, that's one of the issues. But, you know, grass-fed beef will often cook quicker because it's leaner, and it's very complicated or difficult to find a consistent source that has tenderization and moisture. That's the problem right there.
Now, you cover beef really thoroughly in this book, but you also cover other meats, and I was pork, lamb, poultry. Oh, and you have you commented on the feed for lambs, that you like Colorado lamb better than Australian or New Zealand, which is interesting. Well, we happen to have actually two suppliers right here in southwestern Pennsylvania that are pretty top. I mean, one supplies Thomas Keller and someone, and the other one supplies, I don't know who all. But anyhow, and we lived in Australia. And I can tell you that I agree with you totally, that there's a big difference in the flavor of it. And it's just enough that if people only have, say, strong-flavored New Zealand lamb, they're going to say they probably don't like lamb.
Yeah, it's like eating bad fish for the first time. You're never going to want to eat fish again. But I've used the Elysian Farms lamb. That's the purveyor that sells to Thomas Keller at the French Laundry. That is exceptional grass-fed.
It is.
And I'm sure there's some feed. But see, Colorado is just consistent, and they're a larger producer, where Elysian Fields is they're a very small producer, and it's very expensive. So on a general basis for the consumer, consistency will come from that farm, Colorado lamb, and it's filled with fat. And the way I do it in the book is that we sear it first, and then I slather it with mustard and do it in a very classic French way, the persillade with breadcrumbs and garlic and, you know, so it cuts through some of that gaminess and fattiness of the lamb, which is awesome.
Of course, I agree with you. Americans don't eat enough lamb. I was raised on lamb, and I can't imagine not liking it. I just adore it. But you do a lot here in the book on burgers, which I mean, you really elevate the burger to your company. I was very moved by your the Ozersky, since we also knew Josh, and I thought that was just, you've given him shout outs and credit and remembrances and stuff, which I really found inspiring in your book.
Josh was very instrumental in teaching me a lot about the hamburger. I'm here. I just put you on mute. On mute for a second. I'm sorry.
No problem. I thought maybe we lost you.
No, you didn't. I just didn't want you to have to endure the conversation.
Okay,
we're back.
I love your section on tartare. I love tartare as well. I really quibble with your Reuben, however. I am like,
sorry.
That's, you know, as soon as I eat for a living, I really don't ever get major cravings. The one thing I crave is a Reuben.
It's a real New York item, and I just judged the barbecue contest in New York in Brooklyn with the son of Katz's Deli.
Oh, really?
And I got a tour of the facility, and it's amazing because, you know, everybody makes pastrami out of brisket, and I didn't realize that for years Katz has been making them out of Naples. So it kind of opened my eyes to a different type of pastrami, rather.
He's been making it out of what?
Out of beef navel, the bellies. for years.
Really?
Yeah, they don't use brisket, they use navel.
Isn't that amazing? I didn't know that. You have the ultimate, the Zuni Cafe chicken with adaptations recipe in here. You have, what else do you have? You have a pork recipe that I'm so tired of dry out pork. I'm going to try that.
Yeah, you know, we've been dry aging pork too as well, just for short periods of time, maybe 30, 60 days, to develop a little flavor. And it's actually working, but it's a little tricky because, again, you know, each animal is different, and pork will be leaner and dry out a little bit. So it doesn't dry age the same way as beef.
It needs a lot of help, I think, pork, because the way they're breeding it now,
Yeah, it's just
the one I was going to try is the pork belly in the style of Peking duck.
That is my favorite. We brine it in sriracha for 3 or 4 days and then steam it for about 2.5 to 3 hours. And then we cook it on a plancha. We serve it on a steam bun with hoisin and pickles and some sriracha and all kinds of things. So it's really a take on some Asian flavors.
I'm going to do that one. And I'm also going to try, I have a thing about okra, and I'm going to try that okra recipe.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of okra either, but I actually had that. My mother-in-law made that at Christmas 1 year, and I kind of stole the recipe and kind of put a couple of twists on it.
And we just were visiting Peter's cousin in Tasmania, and he grows the best organic avocados you've ever. So we had avocados 3 times a day, but never did it occur to me to have them fried, deep fried avocados.
Yeah, the avocado fries are a phenomenon. You know, when I first moved to Dallas, they took me to meet Big Tex at the Texas State Fair, and I tasted someone frying an avocado, and I was like, God, if I tempura fried this, it would be amazing. It would be truly amazing, and we did it, and now it's like a phenomenon.
Well, you know, you do what I do. You put together some funny, unexpected flavors. My latest one, strangely, is a real high-quality tahini with pickle juice.
Wow. That sounds like Agra Dulce in the making there.
Well, see, my background's Sicilian, so Agra Dulce is...
That's it. I can see that.
And I want to conclude with, you have only one dessert, but it's a sensational one. Chocolate coffee tart.
You know, like you said earlier, dealing with pastry chefs can be extremely complicated and lengthy and difficult. But, you know, at night we don't do the traditional, you know, piece of chocolate cake that's bigger than your entire body.
Right.
Or the New York style cheesecake. So we have a real pastry chef, Eric Cobb, and I asked him to do one dessert, and that chocolate tart, with the espresso granitas. It's, you know, after a nice steak, it gets you up on the table.
Wonderful.
It's like a cup of espresso.
Yep. Well, congratulations on this book, John, and I think that you cover so much ground in it that readers will find something of fascination in every second they spend reading it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and I can't wait for your next book to come out.
Thank you. I can't wait to meet you. Hopefully when you're in Texas, you'll come by and see us at night or at one of our new locations in the coming year. And I thank you for appreciating the book and actually reading it and understanding how much we love beef and care about great steak.
Exactly. Thanks, John.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, our final interview here is with the daddy-o of all barbecues, Steve Reichlin, who is, I don't know what he doesn't know about barbecue, because we interviewed him about many, 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 many of his books, and he has written them many, 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 many books. But this particular one is called Barbecue Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades. So all of these things are as important to it. The fire you cook them on. I can't believe that we have been since 2006 without talking to Stephen Reichlin, who is probably the dean of barbecue and barbecue writers in, would we say, at least in this country, right?
Well, actually, my books are published in 17 languages around the world, and I just finished taping a French-language barbecue show in Montreal yesterday.
Did you? Is that why you're in Canada?
That's why I'm in Canada, yeah.
Right. Did you do it in French?
I did do it in French.
Are you that good in French?
I'm pretty fluent in French.
Wow. So what other languages do you speak?
Besides, if Stephen talks, people pay attention.
Yes.
Well, I'm very fluent in French. I can get by in Spanish, German, and Italian.
Wow, okay. Is there some... I asked you before we came on air. I'm going to do that first. I'm going to ask you again. You originally published this book, Barbecue Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades, in 2000. And I asked you what the difference was between that edition and the current one, which we just got, 2017.
Well, this book has been completely updated. I've added 50 new recipes, so 25% of the book has never been published before. And with the other recipes I went through, I updated them to modern tastes. I eliminated some of the older recipes that didn't seem pertinent anymore. We've added color photography throughout the book. So it's really a very different book than the earlier version.
You have, when you were talking about languages, you have more foreign-influenced barbecue recipes, right?
There are. This is very much, my beat is very much Planet Barbecue. So obviously in the Rub and American Barbecue Sauce section, those are recipes that are more kind of American-focused. But in the marinade section, the salsas, relishes, and condiment section, the slather sauce section, those are very international.
Well, now, there are so many things involved. Peter was reading the book and said, you know, you could spend your life reading it because there's so much information in it.
Well, thank you, Peter. I try and write books that are pretty content heavy. There's a lot to say about the subject, even a subject like barbecue sauces. You know, you don't stop to think how important all of the flavorings are to barbecue, but they really are the soul of barbecue, the sauces, the rubs, and marinades.
Well, the interesting thing is that you credit George IV of England, or more properly probably his chef, as inventing the name
A1.
Of a wonderful sauce called A1.
That's right. There's lots of history. I mean, Worcestershire sauce has a very interesting...
Yeah, I like that.
History. Ketchup, my God, was named for a Malaysian fish sauce, and it was British sailors of the Royal Navy that brought an affection for ketchup, as they called it back then, back to England, where it was made with walnuts and mushrooms. And tomato ketchup is really only about 100 years old.
Uh-huh.
And you credit that to our fellow citizen of Pittsburgh, Mr. Hines.
That is correct.
And what was the quote? There's a quote around there somewhere that says, "Housewives, do not let your house run out of."
He was a very clever marketing guy, Mr. Hines.
That was him.
That is correct.
Now, another thing that's worth noting here, and it makes your book, I think, even more important, is the world of barbecue itself has changed enormously in the years since you published your first book in terms of the kind of work that's going on in the barbecue kitchen, but also in the interest that the population as a whole has in barbecue. Wouldn't you say?
The interest is absolutely phenomenal. I would say we are a nation obsessed by barbecue. Americans now have 2 and 3 grills. Very often that second grill is a smoker. 40% of us grill year-round, and that's including people who live in Frost Belt states. Barbecue competitions are big news. There are even whole TV shows dedicated to barbecue competitions. So in a sense, we Americans are grilling and smoking and barbecuing more than ever before.
And every region, every little tiny region of the world has its own barbecue, right?
It does, and its own barbecue sauce. And right. In my book, Barbecue Sauces and Rubs and Marinades, you'll find a black barbecue sauce from Kentucky. You'll find a white barbecue sauce from Alabama. You'll find a Chilean barbecue sauce, Argentinian barbecue sauce, a drunken salsa from Mexico. You'll find peanut barbecue sauces from Southeast Asia, even a monkey gland sauce from South Africa.
Yeah, what is
but
that?
But I have to assure you, it contains no primate suffered in its preparation. It does not contain any monkey parts.
Are you sure about that now?
Well, you know, we see.
I'm quite sure. I had some this morning on the set of a TV show in Toronto.
You have Aaron Franklin's espresso barbecue sauce. Now, is that authentic? Would he part with that recipe?
You know, he did part with it. I mean, it's his authentic. He gave it to me first, and then it's in his most recent cookbook. So I got to believe that's the real deal. It sure tastes like what he tastes there.
Well, I mean, you sure know your stuff, and you have such a wry sense of humor. I mean, I love your righteous category. How did you come up with that?
Well, the righteous ribs, you know, for a lot of people, barbecue is a religion, and it's sort of fun playing with that. You know, it has its high priest of barbecue, like Aaron Franklin. It has its fiery religious debates like dry wet rub versus wet rub, and it certainly has its righteous dishes.
I see. Now, one of the important contributions that this book makes is that you have definitions, because I don't think that everybody speaks the same language when they're talking about barbecue. Tell us about that.
Well, if you mean first of all, my definition of barbecue is pretty broad and ecumenical. I use the term to embrace both grilling, which is a high heat direct method, indirect grilling, which is a lower heat method, and true smoking. I use it to embrace the a public event, a barbecue, a meal eaten outdoors, a barbecue, a type of equipment, the so-called barbecue grill. And I do this on purpose because I want to be as inclusive as possible. I know if you come from North Carolina, it means more a dish actually than a verb or a meal, mm-hmm. and that dish is pork. But I wanted to embrace the whole amazing world of barbecue.
Right. Now, can you break down what these terms mean? Base, butters, glazes, sauces, rubs, and marinades. Base, butters, and glazes. And you have bops in there too, don't you?
I do. Well,
and then you have dips. Don't forget the dips and the accompanying things.
Absolutely. One easy way to kind of think about it is that there are three windows of opportunity for adding flavor to grilled and barbecued meats. And the first is when the meat is still raw. And to raw meat, you might apply a rub, which is a spice mixture. You might apply a cure, which is a salt-based mixture used to cure meats for smoking. You might let it soak in a marinade, which would flavor it. You might let it soak in a brine, which cures it for smoking. So these are sort of the ingredients that you use before the meat goes on the grill. Once it's on the grill or smoker, you apply a different sort of ingredient. You might apply a butter, like a garlic butter that you baste grilled shrimp with. You might apply a mop sauce, which is a not particularly sweet barbecue sauce that you swab on meat with a barbecue mop. It looks like a miniature mop.
Mm-hmm.
You might apply a baste, which is usually an oil or butter-based flavoring mixture that is brushed on the meat while it cooks. So that's sort of the second phase. The third phase is once your meat or your seafood is smoked or grilled, comes off to the table. And then there's a different set of condiments you might use to flavor it. Barbecue sauce, for example, or a salsa in the style of Mexico or South America, or a compound butter that you might slice a disc of, let's say, a Roquefort butter and let it melt into a grilled steak. You might serve a chutney. You might serve a relish. So this is the third category. And what's so amazing about barbecue and really great barbecue is what I call a layering of flavor, where you might start with rub when the meat is raw, then a mop sauce while it's on the grill, and then a barbecue sauce when it comes out. All of these things build layers of flavor and give you complexity in barbecue.
Is there someone who historically you can say, hey, these people invented barbecue? I mean, was it the Spanish or was it the Argentine?
Yes, I mean, sure. You could say that a very early human ancestor called Homo erectus, which was the first of the human ancestors to cook meat with fire, and that happened about 1.8 million years ago. So you could say they invented barbecue. Our word actually comes from a Taino Indian word referring to a frame of wooden sticks positioned over a fire for cooking, and that entered the European language around the year 1516. In terms of inventing particular styles, most barbecue has evolved over the centuries, but there's a white barbecue sauce from northern Alabama that was invented by a guy named Big Bob Gibson. I mean, before that, nobody ever thought of white barbecue sauce. So there are a lot of colorful characters in the history of barbecue.
You talk about, and I can't find it in the book, there was a barbecue champion from Illinois. And you described the process for preparing this world-class prize-winning barbecue meats.
Oh, yeah, I think it was Mike Mills of Apple City.
That's
and,
it. Could you
okay.
just
so
run through this? I mean, I'd
sure,
like for somebody to get the idea of how serious this whole thing is.
Absolutely. Well, and there's another example of layering of flavor. So he has a rub that's called a magic dust that goes on first. Depending on the meat, some of his meats he also injects with a sort of marinade that you inject into a meat with a hypodermic needle to give it sort of flavor from the inside out. Then it goes on the grill. Then there's a mop sauce that goes on that, again, sort of adds another flavor, keeps the meat moist. It comes off, it gets lacquered with barbecue sauce, put over a direct flame to sear that sauce into the meat, and finally it gets served with barbecue sauce. So, you know, again, the idea that these are complex layers of flavor.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've seen, like, we've been to the big barbecue in New York City,
Big Apple Barbecue.
And the thing that amazed me was how elaborate the equipment is. And you said it doesn't have to be, but it certainly can be, right?
It can be. And, you know, I also describe in the book how a lot of these recipes are complicated, and they're supposed to be complicated. And they give guys, because, you know, historically, guys were the ones that were we're doing the barbecue, although that is changing very much now, but gives guys a chance to sort of show off. And guys like gear and we like complex things. We like to complicate things. I think in the case of barbecue, complexity is a good thing.
We also like to do things that way you can drink beer at the same time.
And that is also true.
Who is that guy who's at the Nashville, the Music City Food and Wine Festival? He has a whole section of the festival and with like six or eight different chefs cooking different parts of different animals.
But
it's like Pat Thomas or somebody.
Pat
like that.
Somebody. And it's Nashville.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. When I started in this field, barbecue was pretty rudimentary and the knowledge was pretty rudimentary. And I've got to say, looking back 20 years later, that we have made enormous progress. And I think barbecue is really become one of America's most iconic foods.
No, so, but is it your fascination with fire? How did you, live fire, how did you get pointed towards barbecue as your life's work?
You know, it was one of those epiphanies. I remember where I was sitting, what I was wearing, what the weather was like. It was like time slowed down, and I heard this voice from on high that said, follow the fire. It was really this idea that wouldn't it be cool to travel around the world and write about how people grill in different countries and cultures. And out of that idea came my first barbecue book, The Barbecue Bible, which was published in 1998. And the book became an instant bestseller, and it was and I was in barbecue, and I realized that there was so much to say about barbecue because it's simultaneously very broad and very deep. By very broad, I mean that virtually every culture in the world has some version of live fire cooking and some version of smoking. Very deep in the sense that, you know, you can get so deep on any individual subject. I mean, brisket, whole books have been written about how to cook a perfect brisket.
But so you started out actually with a global perspective at the very beginning of your career?
I did. It started out with an idea. It was a crazy idea. And, you know, I guess after I got the book contract, then I thought, holy hell, how am I ever going to do this? But, I started traveling. The first time around, I visited 25 countries on 5 continents. And then I came back and reprised the theme about 8 years ago with a book called Planet Barbecue, where I actually went to 60 countries to write Planet Barbecue. I love the intersection of food and history and culture. And barbecue has let me do all three of those things and make a living.
Even if you never cooked a single recipe out of this book, it's still a fascinating piece of social history and a really important piece of food history, because it talks about how things were developed and who some of the people were who were really important, like Mr. Lee and Mr. Perrin, for example, and Mr. McElhaney, and all of those guys who've made a singular contribution to the lexicon of food that's essentially food that's just burned.
Well, I can't thank you enough for that appraisal. I think many people buy my books for the recipes, and they're an important part of the book, but what gives me the most pleasure in writing a book is the history and culture.
Yeah, well, we were totally absorbed in all that in this book. So
thank you.
So travel safely. Come back again soon with another book.
He's already working on his other book.
I'm sure he is.
Well, as a matter of fact, you know, the last book was a book called Project Smoke, about smoking. That's also the name of my new PBS TV show.
Right.
I'm currently, as we speak, working on a book called Project Fire. So
Fire?
Yeah, Project Fire. So
Project
stay
Fire.
Tuned for that. If all goes well, it'll be out next year.
Okay, well, we can't wait till then.
Stephen, you did a really remarkable job in this book, and I can't congratulate you enough.
Okay, so that's your dose of Southern United States and barbecuing for this week. I'm sure there'll be more in our future, not next week. You never can tell. I don't remember what's going to be in next week's program. But you can find out by joining us same time, same place. So why don't you just do that? And until then,
bye-bye.